Flower Friends. This is a weekly podcast about growing, designing, and selling flowers, and I'm your host, Sarah Nayani. I want to talk about sustainability today, and I don't have all the answers. I would love to hear more answers from other people, but I just want to talk a little bit about what that means to me in my garden growing setup and then also in my floristry setup. And then later on the episode, we're going to get into a discussion on landscape design with my friend Dorsey Kilbourne, and we get to ask her a lot of questions about growing more flowers in a space and how to make it feel like different rooms and get a really great setup if you have a little yard or even a patio or something. And something that I think pairs really nicely with that interview with Dorsey is a conversation about sustainability, because Dorsey and I talk about landscape design, and I'm personally working on ways to make my backyard here in the city more enjoyable. It's kind of just been a space for our dogs in the past, and as I've gotten into growing cut flowers, I've taken more and more of that space over for growing flowers, but I'm trying to also make the backyard a space that's like enjoyable for myself and my husband and my dogs, kind of like a multi-use space. And I'm actually kind of glad that I didn't do that right away when we moved into this house, because I think having the benefit of a couple years of growing cut flowers under my belt, I mean, I'm growing on a very small space, but I have been growing flowers for a few years. And now that I have been thinking a lot more about sustainability in my gardening practices and my floristry practices, I'm kind of glad that I didn't do the yard right when we moved in here and kind of have like a set space back there. I think it's kind of nice to have the benefit of some experience and time living here to sort of figure out what we wanted and then also how to make that more sustainable, because it's great to have a place that you enjoy, but I want it to also be something that is hopefully giving back to the land and the critters and the bugs and everything as much as we're taking from, you know, using and enjoying this space. So first, I just want to talk about the word sustainable, because I think everyone has a little different definition of what that means to them or in their business or in their, you know, hobbies or whatever. But to me, sustainable means trying to not take out more than you're giving back. So basically like trying to keep that equation equal. And that's really, really difficult to measure. But I try to think of things, if I can't like measure that equation of, am I putting in as much as I'm taking out? I try to just always veer towards, you know, if I have multiple options in front of me for my business decisions that I have to make, I try to lean towards the more sustainable option. And to me, that means like less of a carbon footprint, less chemicals, less things that would damage or hurt animals, the environment, and, you know, people in this beautiful city space that we live in. And so to me, that's what I'm always trying to think about, is like, if there's multiple options in front of me, how can I choose the one that is, you know, really the most environmentally friendly for the humans and animals and bugs and birds and everything that we live with and that we want to keep living for a long time. And so I don't have all the answers and I have a lot of room for improvement, but I definitely just wanted to kind of like share some of my thoughts. So I guess we can start on the gardening side. So I do a lot of annual flowers, and I think overall that native perennial plants are probably the best choice in terms of sustainability. And I'll say that for a couple of reasons. If you're using native plants, you're using something that's well adapted over time to the environment that you're living in. And so I live in Seattle. We have a fairly rainy, you know, winter and spring season. And then in the summer and, you know, the beginning of the fall, it's more like a drought. And so it can be hard to find plants that aren't native to here that have those, you know, it's a very strange thing to need or to be able to handle a lot of water in the winter and spring and then have a drought situation or be drought tolerant in the summer and fall. And so if you're looking for plants that are native to your area, they're going to be kind of well adapted to, you know, your climate, whatever that is. And obviously there's climate change, so there's going to be weird swings like heat waves, cold streaks, you know, things that are kind of unusual for the historical temperatures. But overall, I think native perennial plants are a great choice. And another reason, you know, not – it's still related to their water usage, but having perennial plants – is something that is going to be in your space for a long time and is going to kind of grow and fill in the space. And over time will get deeper roots and not need as much water added to them. So annual plants, you know, they're going to have pretty shallow roots because they're only living for one season. You sow the seed in the spring and then, you know, you're picking it in the summer or fall or whenever that crop blooms. And then, you know, so it only needs roots to be able to get water for that amount of time that it's alive, and then it dies or is cut. And so I'm trying to have more perennials in my cut flower, you know, menu of what I'm relying on, although perennials take a little bit longer to get established. And sometimes with things like peonies, for example, you can't harvest off them for the first 3 years that you have them. So I have a bunch of peonies, but I'm not harvesting off them right now. So they're taking up a lot of space in my garden, and that will pay off over time, assuming that we don't move. But I think, you know, there are definitely trade-offs there, but I think over the long term, I've been trying to turn more of my beds into perennial beds. And, you know, perennial plants are also more expensive because most of them you can't really start with a seed, but you go to the nursery and buy a plant or get a cutting from someone that you know. And so they take a little bit of potentially more money or work to get going than just like something that you can start with a seed really easily. And so, but yeah, I think for water usage reasons and then also just for the environment and being well adapted to the environment that you live in, picking, you know, plants that are native to the local area is a great place to start. So I'm trying to do that, but I have a lot more room to go. But basically how I split it is I have flower beds in my front, like sidewalk strip area. And then we have a rain garden, which is also good for water retention, and I'm trying to put more perennial plants into that rain garden, but I do have a few annual beds just along the house on the top of that rain garden. And then in our driveway, we have a bunch of flower pots and beds along the house. And in the flower pots along the house, I've put peonies, so those are perennial. And then I have roses at the end. And then on the driveway itself is all annual plants in the actual raised beds there. So the front part of the house is really my like annual bed area, and I try to rotate crops. I'm actually, I guess technically, gonna try leaving more of my dahlias in the ground. So those are technically a perennial, especially if you're not digging and dividing them every year. And so if I leave those in the beds, I guess technically those beds would become perennial beds. But the majority of my perennial space is in the backyard, where I have roses, mums, daffodils, all my irises, things like that. And so I would say the backyard is slightly more sustainable and like locally adapted than the annuals that require, you know, have different water requirements, et cetera, in the front of my house. So another thing that I try to do with gardening is not use any chemicals or pesticides, and I don't try to do that. I'm fully committed to doing that. I have never used chemicals or pesticides in my garden area. I do have a neighbor who really hates weeds and does not love what I'm doing here, and we have a shared, you know, driveway area, and I grow on my driveway. And I just was on the phone with my sister the other day and looked out the window, and my neighbor was using some sort of chemical along her lawn strip, but it's like very close to my flower beds. And so I was very upset. I didn't go outside because I didn't want to like start anything, but I am going to talk to her about just if she can keep that sort of away from my growing space, because I just don't want to bring that into my space at all. And she wasn't on my space, but it was close by enough that it just made me uncomfortable. But I didn't see exactly what she was using. I just have a feeling that it wasn't good and it wasn't something that I would use in my garden. So, you know, neighbors, that's something you can't really fix in one day. So yeah, I don't use any chemicals or pesticides, and I also have made a commitment not to use neem oil, and I don't even use Sluggo or Sluggo Plus in my garden. A lot of people have said like neem oil and Sluggo Plus, those are great options because, you know, they're better for the environment, and I totally hear that. I think that makes sense for a lot of different operations. My business is small enough, and my business model is I'm able to source in flowers when I don't have enough from my garden to fulfill all my orders. And my customers know that up front. So they're not buying flowers from me thinking that 100% of the flowers are from my garden. And so that allows me a lot of flexibility that many other growers don't have if they're selling their flowers. If you're a home gardener, I think it would be great if you can commit to not using chemicals, pesticides, in your garden. But I understand why, you know, people who are selling these for a living, they can't really have slugs come in and eat a whole bed of flowers because they just put so much time and investment into that bed. And they're using the best product that's available for slug deterrent on the market that's environmental. And so I'm not trying to like poo-poo that at all. I'm just talking today about my business decisions, and everyone has to like decide that for themselves in their garden space. But at a minimum, I think not using chemicals and pesticides is a great way if you're a home gardener or growing small amount of cut flowers, something to try. and then because of the way that I've set up my garden beds, I have created habitat for, you know, different birds, bees, insects, because I'm growing on what used to just be a cement driveway. And now I have 9 flower beds and then like several pots and growing areas on my driveway that used to just be cement. So there was no habitat for any critters or birds or anything to get up in there and have, you know, a safe space. But now there's like protection for insects. They can live, you know, amongst the plants and protects from wind. It's food sources. It's, you know, it's the ecosystem. And so that's pretty cool. And then I added 3 beds on the front, you know, sideways strip. And that was grass before, but it was like, you know, just sort of overgrown. It wasn't creating a lot of habitat. But when I have full grown plants there in the summer, that's a really good space that didn't used to be available. And man, do the birds go after my stuff. I just had a flower meetup with 3 people that have been on this podcast before. So earlier today, I met up with my friends Margaret Ullman Hess, Jess Wesley, and then Kristen Risable, who you've heard from if you've listened to the past episodes of this podcast. And we met up at Margaret's house and did a little walkthrough with her. And I was telling everybody about how there's this crow on my street that got into an argument with my dog at one point, because my dog Smokey is really protective, and he barked at this crow once, and it turned into some ongoing beef with this crow. And so I was telling them that sometimes I go out and walk my dog Smokey, and this crow will follow us around the neighborhood and like swoop over our heads, like really close to my head, to like scare us while we're walking. And it'll just go like from telephone pole to telephone pole, like sitting on the wires, and just like swoop over me. And now this argument has escalated because I looked out the window the other day and the crow was in my dahlia bed on the sidewalk, and it was taking its little beak and it was pulling out every single seedling that I had planted, because I was doing some other flowers at the border of the dahlia bed. And it pulled out the little plugs that I had, you know, grown in trays from seedlings and like nicely planted and watered in, pulled each one of them out, just laid them flat on the surface so that I would know that it was just being a jerk. And then it actually went and did the same thing with my very precious dahlia cuttings. I had some like really hard to get varieties that I had taken cuttings of, and it pulled every single one out in these two beds. It kept like most, if there was an established dahlia plant already, it didn't take that. But if there was a little, like from a tuber, a little sprout coming up, it pulled that out, and that'll grow again from the tuber. But if you pull out a cutting, there's nothing, it was picking at the roots. So I couldn't replant that cutting. So that escalated. And then I put my, like, I have these, I've taken chicken wire and made these little hoop cover things. It's basically like a caterpillar tunnel of chicken wire with no like frost cloth or anything, just to keep the pests out on my street. So I put those over those beds down on the sidewalk. And then there's never really been any critters that have gone after my driveway stuff, but this crow flew into my driveway beds and did that to another two beds of dahlias. And I was able to save some of those cuttings, but it also pulled out all the seedlings, like the annual seedlings that I had planted on the borders of those beds. So all of this is to say, sometimes I'm providing too much habitat for my local my local animals. And if anyone has any ideas of how to calm down crows, someone suggested I should like do a peace offering with something shiny, but literally any tips you guys have, I have to end this beef because he's like going after all my precious things. Okay, wow, that was a side tangent. So back to what I'm thinking of in terms of sustainability for my garden. Another thing that I do is reuse all of my seedling trays and all of my plastic pots. If I ever buy plants in from the nursery, I just rinse out those pots. You might have heard on the episode with Kristen that I don't do a lot of like in-depth washing of those. Some people suggest to like really, you know, clean those out. But that's more water usage, and I just kind of like leave them out to bake in the sun and hope that if there was any like fungal issues or whatever in any soil residue in that pot, that the sun bakes it out. So yeah, basically trying to reuse any plastic that I have in the garden. If you use things like frost cloth or plastic sheeting, which I don't really use much of, I know I should, but I try to reuse those if I ever use those from year to year instead of like starting fresh each year. So basically anything you can do to like reduce the amount of like products, plastics, things that you're bringing in. And if you do bring those in, trying to reuse them. So that's kind of what I think of. Oh, and another thing is that I try to use mulch and or like a nice thick compost on the top of my beds so that I don't have to put as much water into the flower beds. And some areas that I think that I could improve is, I mentioned on the last episode, looking for more peat-free compost and soil. It is a little bit hard to find in the U.S., and that is something I'm looking for recommendations on. If people have good resources for where to get more peat-free products, I would really appreciate that. Another thing is that I compost everything. So like if I'm, you know, cutting things in the garden, I mean, unless it has like a virus or a problem, I will throw it in the trash if there's something that has a virus. Because even in the commercial composting, like, I don't know, I don't want to spread that virus. But if it's like healthy plant material and I'm just trimming it or, you know, leaves, I will put those right into the city compost bin. But I do not have a compost on my property, and largely because in the city we do have a bit of a rat problem. But I think there's got to be a way that I can set up like, you know, on-site composting where I can compost my own healthy plant material and other, you know, food waste and things like that, and have really beautiful like soil and compost created right here on site. And I think that that would prevent, you know, having to have things delivered, having to buy in bags that are, you know, covered in plastic, and, you know, just kind of reduce my usage of resources, if that makes sense. So those are a couple areas. And then also, I'm going to admit something right now. This is like kind of embarrassing to be like on my third year of like really, really growing plants, but I do not have drip irrigation installed. I still hand water everything. And the reason that I do that is A, because I've been too lazy to like figure out drip irrigation, and B, because a lot of my beds are on a driveway in front of like a fence, and I haven't figured out how to get drip irrigation like running over my driveway because I can't like dig under the driveway and have it come out. But also, I really love to hand water, which I know is weird, but I have a small enough space where I can do that. And I love to like have that evening time to like check in with my plants. It's really the best time when I can focus on each one. And I try to only water like either really early morning or late in the evening when it's not like the super bright hot sun. And I find that I can see things on my plants better, like find insect problems or anything like that. I can see a little bit better at those times of day. And so anyway, I do want to install drip irrigation because when I'm hand watering, I'm using a watering can. I try to water just at the base of the plants unless I'm doing like a foliar feed, in which case I would like water the plants themselves. But if you do drip irrigation, it does more of a steady stream of water throughout the day at certain intervals that you can set it at. And I think overall, you probably end up using less water because your plants have a more consistent water schedule, and it's not as much water that you're losing to evaporation. So those are some areas that I think I could improve. And yeah, I would love to hear other people's ideas about what you do in your garden to try to be sustainable, and other things that we can all think about. That would be great to hear. So you can, when I say like I want to hear from you, I'm mostly talking about, I think Instagram would be a good place to do that, or you can email me at sarah@growgirlseattle.com, and then my Instagram is @flowerfriendspodcast or @growgirlseattle, and I just love to hear like ideas from people about what they're doing and different experiences. And next season we'll actually have some more guests on, and these are some of the topics I want to ask them about as well. So if you have questions or ideas of what other people are doing, feel free to send them my way and I'll ask season two guests. I was thinking that I could fit a discussion on the floristry practices I do for sustainability right into this convo, but this is going to be like an hour-long podcast of just me talking if I do that. So I think it makes really good sense to keep the gardening stuff today with my landscape guest, Dorsey. And then we'll just plan that for the next episode next Monday, that I'll talk about the things that I do to try to be sustainable on the floristry side of my business when the interview is with Alyssa from Color Theory Design Co., which is like a huge get. Very excited to chat with her too. So if you want to hear more on that side of once the flowers are cut, feel free to tune in next week for that discussion. I'll make sure to talk about it before the interview with Alyssa. So my flower fact trivia question for you today is, what flower does saffron, the spice, come from? Did you know it comes from a flower? Okay, don't look it up. Try to think about what it might be. Listen to the interview with Dorsey, and then on the other end, I'll meet you back and tell you where saffron comes from. All right, on the pod today, I'm so excited to have one of my closest friends in the world, Dorsey Kilborn. She works at Blossom in Portland, Oregon, and she's here to talk landscape design with us today. Hey, Dorsey.
Hi.
Dorsey and her husband have a new little baby, Lennox Lee. Well, I guess not new since August, but thank you so much for fitting us in with your nap time schedule.
Absolutely.
So can you tell me a little bit about Blossom?
Yeah. So Blossom is a landscaping company here in Portland. We do primarily residential landscaping, primarily kind of Northeast Portland, but we work kind of all over the metro area. And so we do all the way through the process. So designing, that's when you work with me. Installation is like, we have three designers and we do installs throughout, like we kind of work people through all the way through the whole process. And once you get your finished installation, then if you want to hire us for maintenance, you can do that too. I mean, it's a full scale affair.
That's awesome. So let's just start with the very basics. Can you kind of tell us what landscape design is?
Yeah. So I think about landscape design as creating more space for yourself to live in your home. So I'm a residential landscape designer. So I think about it on a residential scale. There's lots of different kinds of landscape designers. But when I meet with a client and we're talking about what they want to do with their yard, I'm thinking about all of the different ways that we can like enhance their lifestyle within their property. So lots of different rooms. We think about the outdoor rooms that we're creating, a living room, a dining room, a kitchen outside.
Ooh, I like that thought.
Yeah. What are you doing? What do you like to do outside? Lots of people like to, grow vegetables, grow flowers. Lots of people are like, I don't know. I don't really do much. I just sit and I'm like, great. Okay. Relaxing. We can like create a whole plan for relaxing. I always design with like habitat and, birds and bees and bugs and soil in mind. Those feel like those are like a given. We're going to figure out how to bring in as many creatures and as much habitat and as much pollinator species as possible. But we think about circulation. We think about the rooms and the space that we're creating for the humans, because kind of all around we can create like the space for the native species.
That's really cool. Yeah. I had never thought about it in terms of rooms before, which is maybe why my backyard is one open space that's very muddy and kind of dog territory, but
yeah, it's really nice to like, especially when you have a big space or when you have a space and you're kind of like, you look out and you're like, ugh, I don't know what to do with this space. You think about like, one of the things is it's too big and we actually exist in like smaller spaces and we like to feel like we're inside of a place, like we're cozy. Mm-hmm. And so when you're like out in your backyard, you can just kind of, you're like looking across the vastness and you're like, I don't know what to do with this.
Well, tell me a little bit about like your personal design aesthetic. What are some things that you like to go for? You would be like, oh, a Dorsey signature, I would say.
So I have gotten into a lot of like children's play features, but they're like natural play features. So I kind of just like stumbled into this, but with like one of my clients a couple years back, they had a really small yard and a young child, and we were trying to do like everything. So, they needed a patio. They were putting in like a pool, a shipping container pool in their backyard. They wanted like a place for the kid to play. They wanted a ton of like plants and trees and like lighting. And it was just like a lot for this little yard. Oh, a big storage shed. And so I started to think about like kind of kids play as happening alongside everything else, instead of like, oh, let's put this play structure up and turn this whole backyard into like a swing set. So I do a lot of like log rounds, kind of like stumps with like, you can like jump between the stumps. We do like balance beams across the top of the stumps. I've done like climbing walls or like climbing, like you climb up like a netting to the top and then you like jump over the top, kind of like obstacle courses type things, but they're like around the outskirts of the garden instead of like the main feature of the garden. I've done a couple like swings. I call them like swing portals. So like one of the things about gardens is you can create like an entry space to the garden. So you put in like, a trellis or like a portal. I usually call them portals because that's a cooler word.
Yeah, way cooler.
Yeah. So you can like, I've done like a series of kind of archways or portals, and then like one of them or two of them has a swing attached to it. So it can be like, it's like a cool pathway for adults and you can grow things on them, but also you can just like stick a swing in the middle here and there, and then you can like clip it off to the side when it's not in use. So like multifunctional things. And then, I mean, when I first started, I was doing a lot more kind of organic, like circles and meandering paths and things. And then when you really get kind of into the nitty gritty of how to maximize space in, urban landscapes, I found that I've steered away from organic shapes a little bit. And now it's a little like my gardens have a little bit more of like a modern touch. Things are more like rectangular and square. They're like intersecting, but because you're operating in like a rectangular space with a rectangular house, a lot of the time, the best way to maximize space is to think about how you can like push and pull those existing shapes and have them work with each other instead of trying to like smash a circle in to a rectangle. I don't normally do that very much anymore.
But yeah, no, that makes total sense. I think a lot of the listeners of this podcast are going to be sort of on the urban growing side. Because I think one of the reasons I wanted to start the podcast is there's several podcasts about like flower farms and like huge scale acreage operations. But for someone that's growing flowers in a city, or in this case wants to like design a backyard in a city, they're going to have a smaller space. So I think maximizing that is a topic that keeps coming up when I put like questions out for people to ask. It's how can we maximize space? So it sounds like a rectangular shaped yard, if you're not doing like a meandering circle, you're going to probably have a little bit more space, or it might feel bigger.
Yeah. I mean, it's an easy way to cut up the space too. So like, think about like your patio as a rectangle, and then maybe there's like a shifting path coming off of the patio, and maybe all along the shifting path, you're growing your flowers, and your shifting path is it headed to vegetable beds? Is it headed to another patio where maybe your fire pit is? Is it headed to your hot tub? What, like, where is it headed? But, or is it headed to your little, like your flower production area? I don't know, but there's a lot of different, like, again, breaking it up into rooms. So okay. Thinking about like, you have your one space where you hang out, then you have like your transition to your next space where you hang out, or where you garden, or where you grow your flowers, or what, but what's happening along the way, how are you getting there? And like, kind of, how can you use every inch of the space?
Okay, great. Well, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into landscape design?
Oh yeah, sure. It's a long story. I started out in environmental nonprofits way long ago, and I hated my job. And
I remember those days. San Francisco is ringing a bell.
Yes. And I basically like quit my life and moved to a farm in Maui. And I lived on a farm in Maui for like 4 months. And it was sort of an apprenticeship program. And I got like some basic information about like farming, vegetable farming, and kind of perennial farming, because it was we had palm trees. And so we had coconuts, and we had like papaya trees, and we had mango trees. And so it was like not necessarily a ton of intensive annual vegetable growing. So we were like tending to a forest almost that was existing. So like, but then lower stuff too. So, I mean, we had chickens and we had pineapples, which are like smaller, and we had like peppers, and but most of the stuff that we were managing was not like, okay, you put the seeds in the seedling house, you move the seedlings and transplant them in the field, and then you, like, super labor intensive. We were tending to like a kind of, I mean, it's almost like a food forest.
Wow.
The farm manager was a permaculturally trained, he went to the UC Santa Cruz farm program. And then he had been like in the world of permaculture for a long time. And so he kind of like did a couple of little mini courses with us on permaculture intros. And then when I got back to San Francisco, I took a PDC, a permaculture design certification course, kind of like permaculture 101. And it's like, you know, like 101 courses in college, they're like a mile wide and an inch deep. And you're like, I didn't actually learn anything. I like learned the beginnings of so many things that my head is spinning, but I don't actually know anything. and there's like not a lot of follow-up courses for that kind of thing. So I was able to find one follow-up course, which is basically was this one permaculture teacher in Sebastopol, California, who just recognize that was the case, that like there was no way to go deeper unless you were like super self-motivated and maybe you like found someone who wanted to like mentor you. So he started like an intensive permaculture certification course. It was a year long, and it was like kind of like a vocational program almost. So I it was like design, install, tending, kind of homesteading. It was like everything together. And I ended up meeting a woman who was a professor at UC Berkeley Landscape Architecture School. And I was her assistant, or I worked for her for like 2 years. And basically she just like schooled me up on landscape architecture, drawing styles and the programs. And I went to meetings with her and I just got like a full crash course in the biz. And that was incredible. It's like going to school for free.
Yeah. With an expert too. So not even going to school, but like day to day on the job training.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, really rad. It was, I mean, it definitely, she's a main reason why I am where I am today for sure. Then we moved up to Portland and I got a job for a small landscaping company. That's like a one woman shop. And I started doing some small scale design work for her. And I was also working in the field, doing the installs myself for a couple of years with her. And then I got this job at Blossom like 5 years ago now. And now I've like run the design department at Blossom. So we have 3 designers and, a couple crews, install crews, and we do like very large scale, high end residential landscape design.
Awesome. Thank you. That's really cool. If anyone else wanted to get into landscape design, do you have like recommendations on how, you know, from the path that you took, like anything that you'd recommend? It sounds like you did a lot of hands-on learning and that was the most beneficial for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a big gap in knowledge that comes from people who don't ever get that hands-on information, that that experience, that literally just like shoveling gravel.
Yeah.
I mean, shoveling gravel, shoveling mulch, shoveling soil, like digging and then like filling in all the holes that you dug and then moving everything from one side to the other and then back again. And it's like, I understand how things are built, which a lot of landscape designers out there do not know.
Yeah.
So a lot of people will just like, oh, I can just like draw this line on this piece of paper and like, it'll happen. But I'm like, I know exactly how that's going to happen. And I know, like, because I know how much work it is, I know kind of roughly how much it's going to cost. And so I don't steer my clients in like crazy directions without them understanding what we're talking about and what the cost of that is going to be.
Yeah.
I would highly recommend getting some actual time, like working in the trenches, you know, for that minimum wage job that sucks, but it gets you the building blocks of where you need to go, I think.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings us a little bit into logistics. So do you visit each site before you start designing? Like when a client reaches out, kind of what's the first step you take with them?
Yeah. So with at Blossom, we've done it a couple different ways. Right now, what we're doing is everyone goes through kind of the owner of the company, just because we're pretty overloaded with work. So designers aren't taking that initial call right now. So there's kind of like that sales call that happens. So they call in and they're like, I'm looking for a designer. And Todd Blossom, who's the owner of the company, he's the one that takes that first call, makes that meeting, goes out to the site, kind of walks around the site with the client, hears what they're thinking about, talks about some things, and then puts together a landscape design proposal, which is like, these are all the things we talked about. These are all the things that are going to be included in your design. And this is how much we think it's going to cost to do that. That's a written document. It's a contract. So if they decide to go with us, then they sign that contract and they send us a deposit for that design. And then because we're so busy, there's a large gap of time that happens after that contract is signed before the design begins. So anywhere from a couple months to more than a couple months goes by. And then the next contact is like a meeting. I set up a meeting with the client to go out and basically kind of do the same thing. I mean, we have the information, but I haven't seen the site before. And who knows what's changed in the interim time between contract signing and this meeting. So we walk around, we talk, I come up with some, like we, you know, bounce some ideas off of each other, like, sometimes have to like kill their dreams right away. Like, sorry, that's not going to happen. We can't do that. Or like, yeah, that sounds like an amazing idea. Let's try to figure that out. And then they're off the hook. They get to go inside or go back to work or whatever they're doing. And my assistant or the other designer and I will take our full base mat measurements. So measure like every single thing on the property. Where are the existing big trees and plants? Where are the existing vegetable beds? Anything that we want to stay, anything that we want to go. We measure where all of the doors and windows and exterior electrical outlets and hose bibs and stairs and anything where there's like maybe a grade change, like, oh, we're going to need a step here if we do anything where we're putting in any sort of patios or pathways or whatever. Lots and lots and lots and lots of measurements. Like the page is scribbled and scribbled over with a million different measurements, and then take a million pictures and then go back to the computer and enter all that into the computer. And then there's like, I usually print out that base map and I just like scribble all over it, draw all over it with like scratch paper or trace paper with colored pencils, lots of different ideas. I try to generate like 10 ideas. Like, it doesn't matter if they're good, if they're bad, if they're wacky, if they're like, they feel like a waste of time. Try to go like pretty quick. Like that's, I want that phase to take like, I don't know, an hour and a half to just like kind of dump ideas on the paper. And then usually there's something that just kind of rises to the top right away. And what you're doing in that time is you're thinking about the shapes and you're thinking about the circulation. So like, okay, they want to have they told me they always have 8 people over for dinner. So I need a table for 10. They told me that they love to have late night fires with like their neighbor couple. So I need a fire pit that seats 4. They told me they really want to have an outdoor shower. Where's the outdoor shower going to go? They are really concerned about their backyard neighbor's dog. So we need to figure out like a buffer for the back neighbor, all kinds of different things, but we're thinking about like fitting all that programming, that's what we call it, programming, into the space and how best to do that. So then we have a meeting after I come up with basically 2 kind of semi-fleshed out concepts, go back and have a chat with them. And I'm like, okay, these are my 2 that I came up with that I like the best. Like blah, 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 lots of talking and showing photos and talking through. And sometimes it ends up being like a combination of the 2. Sometimes we love 1. Then I run with it. I go another couple of weeks doing all the real major detail work. So picking out the materials, picking out the plants, thinking about all the edges, thinking about like how things are going to be built. A lot of detail work goes into that second round. And then the next meeting is like, okay, this is it. This is your design. Like you love it, right? Everything's perfect. And they're like, yeah, everything's perfect. Or we change a couple things or whatever. And then there's a final meeting, which is now I've given it to my project manager. We are pricing every little tiny detail element out and come back to you with a price of what it's going to cost to put it in. And a lot of times it's like, oh, we can't afford that. We have to do, you know, half of it, or what can we afford? And that's when the start of value engineering stuff starts happening. And, we eventually land on a number and an installation setup that feels good for everybody.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds like a long, long process. So someone who's thinking about hiring a landscape design firm should probably expect for it to take a while, especially right now with how booked everyone is.
Yeah. Everything's really busy right now. I mean, we're still kind of in this like funny COVID bubble where everybody's been spending so much time at home that they want their yards to be a lot better than they were. And yeah, I mean, not everybody does so thorough and so long and multiple stepped process of design. Some people walk through the yard and they're like, trust me, I have it figured out. Like we can do something over here. We can do something different over here. And this is going to be cool. And I'll just pick out your plants and great. And some people, some people are like, cool. I don't care for the like long, intricate process of design. I like it. I think it's it allows for like thoughtful details, and it allows for a space that feels like really thorough and really like wonderful.
And suited to like the needs of that family or that person rather than just
the
ideas of one person walking through once. It's like more tailored.
Yeah, it's not so much like a plug and play situation.
Got it. Well, getting into plants a little bit, do you have some go-to plants? Well, let's first start with structures and elements. You talked about some arches, swings, things like that. Do you have other structures or elements you like raised beds, or what do you use to sort of create like dimension with structure?
So we do a lot of patio covers.
Okay.
So that can be all kinds of different aesthetics with a patio cover. But
a patio cover, meaning like brick or something?
No, like a roof over your patio.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So, it can be like a steel. It can be like, you know, I think people call it a pergola, but pergolas, in my mind, pergolas are like actually more like arbors. Like they don't have a roof on them. Mm-hmm. They're like, open framing, and then maybe you grow a vine on it or something. But a patio cover is like, it has a roof. Like it could have a steel roof. It could have, like a corrugated metal roof. It could have a plastic roof. Like my pergola that in the back, or my patio cover in the back, has like a, it's a polygal material on top. So you can see through it. It lets light in, but it keeps the rain off. Great for the Pacific Northwest. And talk about creating a room. I mean, it actually creates a room, and you can like string up lights. You could even hang like a chandelier from the middle of it. I mean, you could like create an actual room out there.
Yeah. And just at your house, I mean, we like have dinner outside in like February because there's a table out there and it's not that cold if you bundle up a little
bit. Yeah. And you can put a heater, in those things. And like some people, you can put up like curtains, and then they actually like kind of close off. So we do a lot of those. We do a lot of like decks, and we do a lot of fences and kind of different sort of privacy screening. There's all kinds of different ways to do it. But like something that feels a little bit taller for vines to grow on, or maybe it's just the actual screen is wood or metal or something that just like blocks. Oh, I don't want like that neighbor's second floor window looking down onto me while I'm doing whatever. We do a lot of vegetable beds. The vegetable beds that we build primarily are made out of either 4x4 or 6x6 juniper timbers.
Okay.
So, they're beautiful. They're like, they're a native wood to a sustainable and native to the Pacific Northwest. They're like grown specifically for this. And what they do actually is they like, it's like a small tree, and they just like basically shave the bark off of it and turn it into a 4x4 or a 6x6.
Wow.
So there's like a little bit of roughness to it. You can see little pieces of bark still on it.
I like that.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And we stack them kind of like Lincoln logs almost.
Okay, cool.
And then you just like drill down like one piece of rebar or one big screw down in to hold it together. It's like really easy to put together. They last forever because they're, you know, 4 inches instead of made out of like 2x4s or 2x8s or whatever.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of those for people. A lot of patios, we do like built-in benches, built-in corner benches. If we're trying to like maximize a corner and like, and create like a view in a certain direction, you can like put a bench in and you're like, oh, you have to look at the garden this way.
What would you say, and I think we'll come back to these in some questions, but maybe just 3 or 4, okay, maybe 5 or 6 of like, what are like your go-to plants that in most designs you're going to use these in some way?
Oh my, well, I always put grasses in. So bunch grasses, have an amazing, there's so many different kinds. And they hold a lot of different space. They can kind of lock down a lot of different spaces in the garden layers wise. So I think about the garden as, you know, having many layers. There's the ground cover, the sort of like sub shrub layer, the perennials, the shrub, and then like the like the large shrub or small tree, and then like the full grown tree, the big ass tree.
The big ass tree. I like that. Let's let's coin that phrase right there. These are the official layers of the garden.
A lot of people don't have that big ass tree, which is nice because they take up a ton of space in an urban garden. My big ass tree is a bane of my existence. So. But grasses are really good at kind of this lower to middle layer. And they have this wonderful texture. They blow in the breeze and they look different throughout all the seasons. And those seed heads are like so lovely. It's like this weedy color. You can like put them up against the front of the house and they like do a lot of like modern things if you plant them in rows or in bunches or in swaths, or you can like pop them all over the place in different kinds and different styles and different shapes and different sizes, and they create a, you know, more kind of naturalized garden. So I put grasses in every garden. I put manzanitas in almost every garden. So manzanita is another Pacific Northwest, like there's a lot of native varieties. They're not as easy to find at the nurseries, but there's like a couple really nice, they're super structural. They're like kind of architectural. They have this incredible dark red bark. The bark like peels off in this beautiful way in the spring. They flower and they're evergreen. They're like the perfect shrub. Yeah. And there's a ton of different kinds. And a really good resource for looking at manzanitas, if you're interested, is Xera Plants, X-E-R-A. It's a nursery in Portland, and they have this specific page about Arctis diphyllus, which is the manzanita. And they have little drawings of the shape of each manzanita and like the size and the spread.
Wow.
And so you can, I mean, it's really important to kind of know, obviously, how big your plant's going to get and what shape it's going to be when it's finished, and think about the garden as like in its mature state, not in its baby state. And those are like, you can like plan a whole garden around a manzanita. Other plants I love Edgeworthia is another really cool plant, not a native. It's like from China.
What does that look like?
It's a, so it blooms on bare stem. It blooms from the tip of the bare stem. It's kind of like a chrysanthemum flower almost. Yellow and like white, like yellow and white, or like orange and white. The orange and white ones are harder to find. It almost like kind of starbursts off the tip of the branch. And then when it dies back, the leaves pop out from right behind it. So there's like, it's like this really interesting style of growth that is just not, I don't see it. I put a lot of red flowering currant in. That's another native that's so stunning. They're sort of like tassel-y red flowers. I love boxleaf azara. That's a sort of small to medium sized tree that's also evergreen, but it's not needles and it's not big glossy leaves like a camellia. It's like small leaves, very delicate, super cool tree. Azara macrophylla. I love oak leaf hydrangeas. Those are incredible.
So when you like are thinking about a space and what to put in, are you kind of thinking about like the structure and room first? And then I think you said something about like, you're kind of thinking about plants last because you're kind of wanting to like design the space. And so when you start thinking about plants, are you thinking about the biggest plants that will be in the space and how they'll fill out? And then you're thinking about like the lower levels or?
Yeah, you got it, girl.
Okay. Oh, cool. All right. I'm getting this from you. So
yeah. So I think about a lot of the times when I'm drawing that first, like, shapes and blobs diagram, I like throw a couple of trees in there, like small trees, because I'm like, okay, it's a way that like a tree will break up the space. That's a way to create a room, is to like throw a couple of plants in, like, oh, we're gonna like throw a cup, like maybe we throw like 5 oak leaf hydrangeas in right here. And you're sitting behind this like hedge of oak leaf hydrangeas. Aww. And you can't see what's happening on the other side. because you're in this little room that's like your little, maybe it's your like, I drink my coffee out here. I have my wine at the end of the day. And like Vikram's in the other room, you know, grilling or whatever, right?
I love that. Yeah. I want my little morning coffee space, my little room for coffee drinking. And I want it to be next to 5 hydrangeas too. So you're really nailing my vision here. For my backyard, and it seemed to be a lot of interest on this on Instagram too, when I posted that I was interviewing a landscape designer. Just flower borders or like a border against a fence. That seems like something that people can kind of like take on at home a little bit. Do you have some basic how-tos on like what to consider in terms of height and spacing?
So it's obviously all depends. But I would say that like first you want to think about like what height do you want the tallest thing to be?
Okay.
So you know, I would definitely absolutely start with like the biggest thing.
Okay.
You have to leave room for the biggest thing. So you have this 5-foot fence. Do you want actually 10 feet of protection? Do you want like your neighbors not to be able to look over the top of a fence? Do you want them to? I don't know. Do you have very little space? Is your border 10 feet deep? Is your border 4 feet deep? That changes obviously what you can plant there. Mm-hmm. Do you want evergreen? Are you going to go out there all winter long, or is it in the winter time you just let your dogs out so you don't care what's happening in the winter? I would always think about, like, especially for flower people, you want a flower all the time if you can have a flower all the time. So
definitely
let's think about like all the seasons and planning for like in this border, you're going to have at least one thing in bloom as almost all the time. Right. So sometimes we do like bloom charts. I think you do that, Sarah. So like this, all that you can see, okay, this blooms from May to June. This blooms from July to August. It seems like I might have a little break here. I need to find something to fill in here. This blooms from January to March. Oh my God, this is an amazing thing. We have to make sure it goes in.
Yes.
That kind of thing. You want to think about structure in terms of if you're going to plant, like, I mean, a lot of the time when you don't have any space and you just need, you want like your ugly chain link fence covered up or whatever, just like put some jasmine or some honeysuckle or some clematis vine. And then you've got that green covered. Mm-hmm. You've got the pretty background covered. You've got the height. I mean, it's like 5 years down the road, but whatever. And then you can think about, okay, how much space in front of these vines do I have? And what can I plant in front of these vines? Obviously you want to think about sunlight. How much sun do these plants need? They all need the same amount of sun and water.
Okay.
So you don't want to plant something that wants no water next to something that wants a ton of water.
Okay. So trying to find like plants that have similar sunlight and water needs, and then kind of starting with maybe either the backdrop or the height, and then filling in from there, thinking about whatever your priorities are, like in a year-round bloom or something like that, that might be someone else's priority.
Yeah. And are you, what kind of a garden do you like? Do you like a crowded garden? Do you like a wild garden? Do you like a garden with like a bunch of space? Like you can see the ground in between each plant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Are you a tidy gardener? Like, and you want to plan for that too. So when you're planning out your space, plan for the mature size of each plant.
Okay.
And then you think about, okay, do I want these things to touch each other? Do I want them not to touch each other? And how does that work its way? Or do I not care?
Yeah. I personally don't, but I know a lot of people probably do. So should things look pretty bare at the beginning and they're going to fill in over time? Like this is one thing that I don't do that well with is when a seed chart or a plant that I'm buying has like the amount of space listed on it, it's like, give this plant 3 feet of space. I'm like, no, we don't need 3 feet.
Well, they don't.
So you're saying maybe to think about that. And then,
I mean, they don't need that 3 feet. That's 3 feet that they will take up, but they can take it up in conjunction with another plant. I mean, the plants can grow together. they can like touch a little bit here and there. But yes, I mean, I think like I love planting day at projects because it's like, yay, it's done. Sometimes clients come home and they're like, oh no, not full. It's not as full as I was expecting. I'm like, yeah, I know. We put in small plants. Planting small plants, A, it's cheaper. B, they have a higher success rate usually because they're like not super like hooked on fertilizer and chemicals and the perfect conditions of the nursery.
Yep.
So they're like a little bit hardier and ready to just be like plopped in the ground and kind of walked away from. So we plant small plants, and I don't feel like you get a ton of a head start by planting larger plants. Like if you are planting something really slow growing, then maybe you want to, you know, get a slightly larger plant, but like then you've spent sometimes 10 times as much money on that one plant. And then you're like freaked out and it's going to go through a stress cycle. And so it like might even like, you know, it's not going to grow right away. So like the smaller plant will just start growing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm just like pretty into smaller plants to get things started. And then you get this like real sense of accomplishment. Like I saw you when you were born.
Yeah. And then you kind of grow with your garden.
Yeah.
Is there something you could do? Like say that you're planting 6 grasses in a row or something, and there's a lot of space in between them at first. Could you put like an annual or a nasturtium mm-hmm. or something there that will kind of cover that bare
absolutely.
Ground or mulch? Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. My front yard. So I don't do this with clients that often because it's a little bit wild and you have to maintain it. But like in my front yard, I put all my perennials down and my shrubs. And then I just sprinkled wildflower seeds everywhere.
Ooh.
And like 1 year later, my garden was full because wildflowers are annuals. I mean, they're going to come up completely. So like that first summer, we had a beautiful front yard full of flowers. Then for like the next 5 summers, I was like ripping them out, trying to make sure that like the California poppies weren't taking over the entire front yard.
That's- yeah. And that the perennials you planted and paid a lot of money for could actually.
Yeah. You have to manage them, but like it absolutely gives you, and like we still have, which is like now it's perfect balance. So we still have like probably, I don't know, 15 or so little sprouts of California poppies that pop up throughout the garden, which is like exactly what you want. And like a couple bachelor's buttons here and there, not like an overwhelming field of blue bachelor's buttons, which is another thing that we went through. But like, I wouldn't do that to a client because clients are just going to be like, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed. But in your own garden, especially if you're a flower gardener, like absolutely annuals are and seeds are such a great tool for filling in a garden right away.
Okay, great. And then a couple more things. How do you keep weeds at bay for your clients or in your own house? Are you like big on mulch? Are there any like organic ways? Do you use landscape fabric?
Have you ever heard of weeding?
Yes, I hate weeding.
I know, it's so horrible. Yeah, no, we use a lot of mulch, but it doesn't, that's not going to stop weeds.
Okay.
I hate landscaping fabric. The only place I use landscape fabric is underneath patios. And I don't even understand why we do it there, but I'm not going to fight the crews on that one. But it's absolutely pointless. The number of gardens that I've dug up where there's like landscaping fabric buried under 6 feet of soil and weeds and rocks, and like, it's absolutely a waste. It's just putting a bunch of garbage into the ground. Instant garbage.
Wow. That's really good to hear.
I hate it. I hate it. Hate it. And I refuse. Some people are like, oh, can you put landscaping fabric down and then cut into it and put the plants in? So there's fabric all around the plants. I'm like, nope, I will not do that.
Okay. This is a good, fresh opinion because especially for flower people, I think a lot of flower farmers in particular, and this is because it's for spacing. They like burn holes in landscape fabric to the exact spacing that that plant needs. And it helps on like a large scale to help with weeding. But I think on a smaller scale, it sounds like it might not be. And that's a very different type of growing than what you're doing. So I think just be prepared for weeding and just try to put down mulch or something that might help with weeds.
Yeah. I mean, mulch will give you a little bit of time and it just makes it look fresher and it's nice. It's good for the soil. It's very good for the soil to put down mulch. You don't want bare exposed soil anywhere. but it's not really going to do a ton for you in terms of weeds.
Because it's also organic. And so things can grow from the mulch.
Yeah, you can grow it. They can grow it. Yeah. And like when you've done a big garden project and you've like aerated all the soil and turned it over and like put a bunch of water into it and a bunch of nutrients, I mean, you're going to get weeds in there too.
Definitely. Well, okay. So just a quick, if someone was going to plant a border at their house along a fence or in between rooms, and they wanted to include some flowers in that border, could you just give an example or two of like what you might plant? If someone comes to you and says, I really like flowers, I want a border here, you pick the plants, like what would be some things you might use?
Okay. Well, I saw this question, so I wrote down three different options. This is so depends, but like it depends, what is it, your front yard? Is it a sunny yard? Is it a border on your patio? Is it a border on your path? Is it a border on your driveway? Is it, like, I was thinking low borders. I planned for low borders, and I planned for, it's mostly sunny. So there's like, you know, sedums, those low, super low. So that sedums are kind of the very first thing. If you're walking along, you see the lowest thing, or, you know, they're 1 inch off the ground. Behind that, it would be like a mix of grasses and perennials. So you could do any kind of grasses. I do a lot of, tufted hair grass, which is a native, cool all season grass. And then I do a lot of cone flowers, yarrow. I love tulips, geum, allium, all these different, perennials and bulbs that I love the image of, or like the aesthetic of flowers popping up through the like waving fronds of grasses.
Oh, I love that.
So that's one of my go-tos. And then rock rose is a great border plant. So cistus, pretty low. There's all different kinds of them. There's different color flowers of them. They're evergreen. They're low. They're like in this kind of silvery family. They're really cool. They look good all year round. It's kind of a low mound. So you want some spikes behind it. You want some like some fluff behind it. So again, I put grasses everywhere, like I said. So grasses. And then phormium is another one of my go-to plants. It's a beautiful kind of, it's like a strappy grass texture. It's not really a grass texture. It's kind of like an aloe almost, but it's like floppy. It's like a strap grass. I just made that up, but I feel like it makes sense. Evergreen, lots of different colors, lots of different sizes, more substantial texture to it than grasses. And it's like a good, you know, like you have your rock rose level, then you have your like wavy low grasses with your like taller seed heads. And then you have this like strappy grass in the background. Another one, creeping rosemary. I love creeping rosemary. It's great for like dripping over walls, any sort of like border where it just like wants to be low and is like, if there's any grade change, creeping rosemary is so great for like dripping. They do those beautiful blue flowers this time of year. And then blue, so this is a blue one. So creeping rosemary, blue fescue, which is another one of my total go-tos. It's like a 1x1 grass, super like compact. It's like literally, it's like blue.
Okay.
So cool. And it has little like very kind of standard looking little seed heads, like wheat seed heads. And then lavender behind that. Boom. You have yourself a nice blue border.
I love that blue border. Thank you, Doris. Okay. I'm going to do a little bit of rapid fire right now. We had some listener questions. So the first set was really about like types of plants. So do you have recommendations for drought tolerant plants?
Yeah. So manzanitas are good for that. Grasses like bunch grasses don't need a lot of water. Rock rose doesn't need a lot of water. I would honestly send everyone to the Xera Plants website. They have a really good website. Xera.
Xera. Everybody go.
Yeah. It's a wonderful website. There's like, it's two just like of the nerdiest plant guys you've ever known.
Oh, we love a nerd.
They write all of their descriptions so beautifully. They have, the website is like searchable, so you can search for drought tolerant, drought adapted, climate adapted, like all those words are kind of going to be, you know, xeric. Like their entire nursery is named after plants that don't need a lot of water.
Okay, great.
So like there's a silver leaf oak in my front yard that I love. That's like a tree that doesn't need a lot of water. Natives, a lot of natives, like if you think about not the like woodland natives, but if you think about what are the native varieties for like more maybe your coastal plants, your like West Coast plants, like out towards the coast, they don't need a lot of water. Like don't plant a willow like I did in my front yard. So silly. Does not work. Not happy.
Do they need a lot of water?
They need a lot of water. They don't like the sun. I put it right in front of my west facing house, right up against the house wall. That's the hottest possible place for it. I'm looking at it right now thinking, what was I thinking? Rosemary doesn't need a lot of water. Don't plant a crepe myrtle. Crepe myrtle likes water. Don't plant that. That's a really cool flowering tree, but it likes water.
It needs water.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what to plant in shade besides ferns?
Heuchera. That's a coral bell. Is a good one for shade. A stilbe, good for shade. There's so many different kinds of ferns. Don't write ferns off because you don't like one of them. There's a million different kinds. Like check out holly ferns. Those are super cool. They have like more larger glossy leaves. I mean, camellia doesn't need a lot of sun. Hydrangea, if it's like pure shade, a hydrangea is not going to like it. But if it's like dappled shade, a hydrangea would take that.
Okay. And then tips on irrigation, if you have them.
So we install irrigation. We install all drip irrigation. We install it, connected to the main water line. So you have to do like, it's installed in the ground. It's all automatic. It's on a timer. You need a plumber's permit to connect to the main water line. So like even our company has to like hire a plumber to come out and do that first connection. It's a ton of like trenching. It's a big, big project to do the kind of installation that we, the kind of irrigation installation that we do. There are very simple. They're almost like erector sets or like plug and play, like simple irrigation that you can buy at like Ace Hardware. And you want to understand, it connects to your hose bib. There's a little timer that connects to your hose bib. And then you can do like, it's like at above ground, the same kind of tubing that we use in the professional installations. You don't have to dig the trenches and lay the PVC piping and all the stuff, the big valve boxes that we do. You just like run it to each, you know, you want to understand how much length you need. Think about you're going to run angles. You're not going to necessarily run like, I don't know what you're going to do, but you're just going to lay it out so that it wraps and comes near to the root area of all the plants that you're needing, that are needing water. Cover it up with mulch when you're done with it. And then the biggest advice I have is the schedule that you put your plants on. So, what you want to try to do is you want to try to create resilient plants that don't actually need a ton of water input once they're like established. So the irrigation, if you think about irrigation as being like for the establishment phase primarily, and then maybe like in August when it hasn't rained in 2 months and like things are looking a little raggedy, you can turn it back on. The way to do that is that you want to water for a long period of time so that the water percolates deep into the root zones. You don't want to water often for a short period of time because all that does is water gets like a couple inches down below the surface of the soil. And then your plants end up with, yes, superficial roots. What you have to do, it's like complicated to think about. There's like a whole class you can take. But if you think about, you run your irrigation, you set your irrigation up, you run it until you see, it's starting to not percolate. It's starting to like overflow. It's like running onto your patio or your path or your sidewalk. You turn it off and you're like, okay, I ran that for 20 minutes. And then I started to see overflow. So that means that that's the length of your cycle. Your cycle is 20 minutes long. You want to run like, basically you want to run like a bunch of back-to-back 20 minute cycles, like run a 20-minute cycle, take an hour off, run another 20-minute cycle, take another hour off. You can program this into your box, into your irrigation box. That's what we do. It's complicated, but you can do it. And so basically, like, maybe you're running your irrigation for like 6 hours one day. It's running and then stopping and then running and then stopping and then running and then stopping. And then you don't run it again for like 5 days.
So it's basically training the plants that they need to dig deep for water.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really good advice too, because I think a lot of people that might be listening, if they're more on the cut flower side, they're used to watering like every day because they're annuals. But in a lot of these borders and beds and more landscape design, you're wanting to train them to go down instead of, they're not going to have a short cycle. You want them for multiple years. So you want to train them to drink on their own.
Yeah. You want them to live on their own.
Do you have recommendations for where people can find landscape design inspiration?
I use Pinterest all the time. It's not the perfect tool, but it's a pretty good tool. And people put a lot of pictures of gardens on there. Basic searches in Pinterest will give you a lot of stuff. And then I create a board for each of my projects. And, you know, it's very similar to what you use Pinterest for any other type of thing. And then I started following a lot of designers on Instagram lately, and there's a lot of active, like, international designers on Instagram. The people that I follow, I'm not following necessarily for like the perfect plant selection. Like, they, like, they're all over the world, like Australia and London and Los Angeles. And they're not necessarily going to be putting together the ideal plants that I need for my climate. I'm following them more for like materials inspiration, for shapes inspiration, for like interactions, like textural interactions, for different like things that are just, oh man, that's beautiful. How can I create something similar to that? Like that bench, the way that bench and that boulder, the way that like grass is up against that fence is so beautiful. Like, what can I do to kind of mimic that in my garden? So Piet Udolf. Piet Udolf is a very famous landscape architect. Actually, I don't even know if he's a landscape architect. He's like a super, there's a documentary about him. He's a super into perennials and really cool varietals of perennials. And he does this like really, he's like a planting designer. So Charlotte Rowe Gardens is another Instagram account. MCLDLCC, that's a New England landscape designer account. Sunset Mag, they just are like, they are all over the place, but they do occasionally do some fun kind of landscapey photos, like photo shoots of cool homes in Ojai, California, and they're like drooling. Artisan Landscapes, that's an LA landscape firm. Laura.Behr, B-E-H-R, she does these incredible drawings, like sketches of gardens that are just kind of make you melt by how beautiful they are. Blossom. So ours is Blossom Portland. And we post not that frequently because we're busy doing other stuff, but there's a lot of stuff on our website that's cool. And we're like a local, you know, PNW firm. So you can actually look at plant combinations and stuff.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dorsey, and for giving us tips on how to create a really cozy, special place in our homes outside.
Absolutely.
hopefully, hopefully to enjoy that space more year round. So thank you so much. And
thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Dorsey and I grew up together in Maine. We've known each other since seventh grade, so it's really nice that we're both West Coasters now. I get to see her down in Portland a lot. Actually, several of our friends from that friend group moved to Portland, Oregon, and I'm in Seattle, and then our friend Annie's in Boston, my friend Allegra's in Los Angeles. So most of the friend group from high school is our West Coasters now. Love you, Annie. We'll get you out here someday. Okay, so saffron comes from a crocus, which is pretty wild. I didn't know that till a couple years ago. I ordered some from Renee's Garden. I don't know if they'd be available now. They might be, but they're planted, I believe, in the spring, and then they bloom in the fall. And so I've done this before. It's really crazy. They grow these like spindly red strings out of the center of these fall blooming crocus, and you can just pick those out with a little tweezer with your fingers, put it in a little jar, and let them dry out. I just put it on the windowsill to like dry out in the sun, and then you can cook with it. And I hope I'm not spreading misinformation, but I think that saffron is the most expensive spice per like metric of weight. So per pound, a pound of saffron is like the most expensive spice. So it's kind of cool that you can grow that on your own. I think anywhere that a crocus would grow, you can grow saffron. So look that up. It's pretty cool. And I'll post a photo on our Instagram so you can see it. The song of the week this week is an ode to my main friends. It's Long Black Veil by Johnny Cash. And I got to do it in the deep voice. So 10 years ago on a cold, dark night, someone was killed beneath the town hall light. There were few at the scene, but they all agreed that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me.